Let us prepare to start the second. Honorable members, and our esteemed presenters from the Department of from the Land Claims Commission, and that is Ms. Kobodo and the Chief Land Claims Commissioner, and then Mr. Mtontwa. And who is the Deputy Land Claims Commissioner? thank you for coming here, but I think it's better not to come late. It's our government, it's your government. For it to work better, we've got to be on time. But all the same, let us get into the briefing. I think the message has been sent to you as a briefing by the Chief Land Claims Commissioner on unresolved land claims that impact on tourism projects, particularly projects on protected areas like game reserves. So we just wanted to get your take on this matter, because sometimes when we go for oversight, we discover that there are a lot of problems that emerge as you are doing your good work, but at the same time, other problems emerge, and unfortunately, perhaps we are not well geared to approach our problems in an integrated manner. But going forward, we wanted to hear from you the problems that you have had, and then secondly, how you are solving those problems. Because the land claims, as good as it is, should not significantly impact on the other priority, which is an accelerated economic growth that is inclusive, creating jobs and sustainable livelihood, as we develop then the rural areas going forward. So over to you, Ms. Kovoda.
Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I'd like to profusely apologize for being late. In fact, we were at the DC's office quite early. There was miscommunication. Our parliamentary officer actually, I asked him 3 times, is it not 10 o'clock? And he said, no, it's 10:30. It was only when we got the phone call that we realized that he was incorrect. Otherwise, it's not our habit to come to meetings late, and we apologize for that.
In fact, we are building a country.
Thanks, sir. The presentation will be given by Tammy Abdonzo, who is the Deputy Land Claims Commissioner, and he'll be able to give an overview of the situation, and also I will also try and address the questions that you have with regard to this case. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and honourable members, in front of you, we have made copies of the presentation that we are about to make. The only difference between this presentation and what you have is that I will be presenter instead of the Chief Land Claims Commissioner. Yes. Otherwise, it is exactly the same document. The matters that we're going to take you through today are an overview of the restitution program. Progress on the settlement of land claims in general, the settlement frameworks that are applicable when we settle claims in protected areas, progress on the settlement of claims in protected areas, challenges and remedial action. Then the second part will then focus on the claims on the Kruger National Park, which has a slightly different dispensation compared to the other protected areas. If you look at slide 3, we set out the mandate for restitution. It comes from section 257 of the restitution, which guarantees the right to restitution to a person or community dispossessed of rights in land after 19 June 1913 as a result of past racially discriminatory laws and practices. Restitution is one of the 4 elements of government land reform program. The others are land redistribution, land tenure reform and development. The Restitution of Land Rights Act gives effect then to the constitutional right to restitution, and it regulates the process that are applicable in the restitution program. It provides for the establishment of the Commission on Restitution of Land Rights, which is generally known as the Land Claims Commission, whose function it is to solicit claims, to investigate them, and to attempt to resolve them through mediation and negotiation. It also establishes the Land Claims Court, which is the court, a specialist court that adjudicates disputes that arise from the restitution process. A person, a direct descendant of a person, an estate, or a community would be entitled to restitution if it can show that it was dispossessed of the right land after 19 June 1913 as a result of conservation discriminatory laws or practices, and where that person, community, estate, or direct descendant has lodged a claim no later than the 1st of December 1998. Now, there is a process that is currently underway of reviewing the cut-off date for the lodgement of claims, providing for an extension for a period of 5 years. Legislation is currently being considered by cabinet. Then, what we also set out in the presentation is that if in as much as a person may have been dispossessed of their rising land and lodged a claim, if that person received compensation that is just and equitable, calculated in terms of the constitution at the time of dispossession, then that person does not qualify for restitution. Restitution takes place in about 5 forms. When then a person or a community has demonstrated that they indeed lost land as a result of past racial discriminatory laws or practices after 19 June 1913, that person is given restitution either by restoration of the right in land, that is giving the land that was taken, the provision of alternative land where it is not feasible to give the actual land that the person was dispossessed of, the payment of financial compensation, development, or any combination of restoration, alternative land, financial compensation, or development. The process itself of restitution has roughly 5 stages. The first is a stage of lodgement. This is where claims are lodged with the commission. With the cut-off date for lodging claims being the 31st of December 1998, that stage has passed. But obviously, if the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill that is currently in cabinet is enacted, then that date will then be extended. The second stage is that of research. Research involves the investigation of a claim by the commission. When the commission now goes and verifies whether the person in fact qualifies for restitution, and if the person qualifies, the commission will then accept the claim, and if the person does not qualify, the commission will then dismiss the claim. Those claims that are accepted are published in the Government Gazette, and the commission will then go on and determine the household that qualify for restitution for the particular claim. We call that process verification. The third step that is taken is a negotiation that is facilitated by the commission between all interested parties to a claim. The interested parties would be the claimants themselves, the current owner of the land, and if the current owner does not use the land, then any other person that uses the land or has any rights in the land, they will then participate in a negotiation process which tries to find solution to a claim. The fourth stage is that of the settlement of the claim, alternatively the referral of the claim to court. If these parties that participated in the negotiation all agree on a manner in which a claim must be settled, that claim will then be referred to the minister who has administrative powers to settle claims. If the parties did not agree, then the areas of dispute will then be referred to the Land Claims Court for adjudication. And then the final stage is that of implementation, where awards that were made by agreement between the parties or by the court are then implemented. Implementation is in the form of the acquisition and transfer of the land to the claimant or the payment of financial compensation where financial compensation was chosen type of restitution. Historically, three targets were set for the restitution program, and those targets were found in the white paper on South African land policy. Now, the Restitution Act was enacted in 1994 on the basis of a ripe restitution that was contained in the interim constitution. When the 1993 constitution was enacted, the Restitution Act had to be aligned to the 1996 constitution, and in 1997 government approved the white paper on South African land policy. That is where the three targets for restitution emanated from. The first one was a 3-year period for the lodgement of claims, a 5-year period for the actual process towards the settlement of claims, and a 10-year period for implementation of settlement awards and other post-settlement support that government is required to provide to beneficiaries of restitution. The targets for settlement of claims, the initial date when claims are supposed to be settled was in 2000. By 2000, less than 50 claims have been settled, and that was extended to 2005. And by 2005, restitution was still not completed, claims were still not completed. There was a further extension of 2008, and when that one was not met, no target was then given. These targets are mostly a target that would be given by at the level of cabinet, and obviously the targets do not override the provision of the law. So until such time that all claims have been dealt with and the Restitution Act exists, then the Commission must continue towards the settlement of the claim. From inception in 1995 up until about 2006, the focus was mainly on the settlement of urban claims. Approximately 70% of the claims were lodged with the Commission were in respect of the possessions that took place in the urban areas. There were claims in rural areas that were settled during that period, but a bulk of them were only started to be processed in 2006. These rural claims have proved to be more complex compared to the urban claims. They are in respect of vast tracts of land. The claims themselves are most of the time competing, and they have a large number of households and beneficiaries, opening then a gateway for intra-conflict. By the 31st of March 2013, which is the end of the last financial year, 77,334 land claims have been settled. And of those, 59,759 were finalized. Now, a claim is settled when an award has been made. Some of the claims are so complex and they relate to land that is so big that they are settled in phases. Where phase one of a claim is settled, an award is made, and therefore it is counted as a claim that is settled. And then it is finalized when all the land that a claimant is entitled to has been transferred, registered in the name of that claimant, all the financial compensation have been paid. And the Commission basically closes the file, and then it will count that as a claim that has been finalized. So by the end of the last financial year, 77,334 land claims were settled, and 59,758. We can say the files have been closed on that number. These settlements have resulted in the award of 3 million hectares of land at a cost of 10.8 billion. The 10.8 billion is the price that was paid for land that was not owned by the state. Land that was owned by the state, particularly when it is a national government, and that land is owned or is under custodianship of the Ministers of Public Works or Rural Development and Land Reform, we do not pay for that land. Land that is owned by local government, some municipalities will donate, some will pay market value, and others will pay the amount that the municipality paid to acquire the land. for example, land that was dispossessed as a result of the implementation of the Group Areas Act, and the municipality acquired it from a person or from some other organ state that could own land, they paid 450 rand. Some municipalities will require that to just pay that 450 rand, no CPI, no nothing. And that takes place especially in the Western Cape. So 3 million hectares of land have been awarded. 1.4 million of those hectares have been transferred and registered in the name of the claimants. The balance of the land, a bulk of it is state land and mostly unsurveyed and unregistered state land, which was waiting the state land audit. Now that that process is finalized, we are now in the process of transferring that land from the state to the beneficiaries that have been awarded the land. Out of the 77,334 claims at the 31st of March that were settled, 71,292 claims were settled by payment of financial compensation, and 6 billion was paid. Had those people chosen land, we would have given a further 1.9 million hectares. So if you look at the numbers, out of 71,000 claims, people have chosen a financial compensation compared to land. That is an indication of many things. One of them being that there are no alternative sources of income. When people are faced with a choice between land and cash, most of them will choose cash because it will have an immediate impact on their lives, and alternative sources of income are not many. The settlement of the claims then have benefited 1.8 million individuals that come from 369,451 households, and those households, just about 137,000 of them are female-headed households, and 672 are headed by persons with disabilities. Now, when it comes to the settlement framework for claims in protected areas, we are guided by a decision that was taken by Cabinet in October 2002 that land claims on protected conservation areas where claimants have chosen that their land must be returned to them must be settled by an award of ownership of the land without physical settlement by the claimant. So when a protected area is claimed and the community or the claimant wants the land back, ownership of the land gets given to the claimant or community, which is the case most of the time, and they get a title deed. But one of the conditions in the title deed is that they cannot physically settle on the land because the land is being used for the purposes of conservation, and it has been protected in terms of legislation, but particularly the National Environmental Management Protected Area Act of 2003. But what Cabinet had to take into account, it had to balance the right to environment and the right to restitution. Now, Cabinet then directed that this settlement must include sustainable partnerships between claimants and managers of protected area to achieve effective biodiversity conservations of the area, including economic viability, holistic and coherent management. Cabinet also directed that there should be economic benefits for claimant communities, but that settlement should not undermine the economic viability, financial sustainability and holistic management of protected areas, especially national parks, World Heritage Sites, and other areas of high conservation value. So when we deal with land claims on protected areas, this is what guides implementation. Obviously, a decision of government of cabinet is equal to a decision of an owner of the land. If a claimant or a community is not happy with this, they can go. The unhappiness can form the basis of a dispute, in which case then the commission will then be required by the law to refer that dispute to the land claim committee. to them, in effect, to the 2002 decision. In May 2007, the Minister of Environmental Affairs and the Minister of Agriculture and Land Affairs, as the ministries were then known, they entered into an agreement providing for a framework for the settlement of clean protected areas. Basically, that was now a document that would guide the two departments of environment and these days of rural development and land reform in the settlement of claims in protected areas. The framework provided principles which were aligned with the decision of our cabinet. It provided for protocols to be followed in settling land claims in protected areas. You get a situation that is not the same, which is a little bit different to what you would normally get when you are settling a claim. A normal claim is on land that is owned by a private individual, and the commission would be facilitating through negotiation and mediation the settlement of that claim between two parties. When you are dealing with a claim on protected conservation area, it gets a little bit more complex than just dealing with two parties. Firstly, the owner of the land, most of the time, is the Minister of Public Works. The land, because it is protected as a conservation area, the use of that land is given to a national or a provincial Department of Environmental Affairs. So that's part number two. Then thirdly, the land is used by a management authority who most of the time is a management authority that has been established by the state, which then is a third state party. Then you have the representative of government in all claims, which is the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform. So then you have four state parties that must all agree on what to be done. So one of the things that the protocol says must be done is that we must establish a common understanding, a common way forward between these four, and sometimes even more, institutions within government, so that once the position has been developed, that is what will then be used in the negotiation process towards the settlement of the claim. In 2009, okay, maybe before I get to that, Section 42 of the Protected Areas Act says that if land has been protected for conservation, and that land is on, there is more than one party who is involved. In other words, there is the owner and the management authority are two different people. The owner and the management authority can enter into an agreement providing for co-management, and then it provides what that agreement was set out. So the understanding, to get to the principle of economic participation, economic benefit for claimant community, to make sure that there is economic viability of the management of this protected area, holistic management, etc., etc., all those principles that were in the 2002 cabinet memo, cabinet decision, which you find in slide number 8, a co-management must then be entered into. So in 2009, we finalized with the Department of Environment a national co-management framework, which requires that co-management agreement must be entered into, and those co-management must ensure that the claimants receive tangible, realistic, and optimal benefits without compromising the ecological integrity and the long-term objective of financial sustainability of protected areas. And that was in early 2009, and by then we were confident that we had all the tools that are necessary to assist the officials of the commission in the provinces, to assist the officials of the management authorities from provincial Department of Environment to then be able to finalize claim. Then in 2009, the changes were made in government from May. The work of the Department of Land Affairs was taken over by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. The mandate that was given the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform was significantly different to the mandate of Land Affairs. What was then done very quickly was the development of a comprehensive rural development program, which would then be the umbrella policy that would inform the work of the new Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. That was approved in the latter part by Cabinet of 2009. All policies of Land Affairs then had to be aligned to the policies of rural development and land reform, including the manner in which land claims are settled. By September 2011, the Green Paper on Land Reform was published following its approval by Cabinet, and that Green Paper set three principles that underpin land reform. Everything that is done in land reform is measured against these three principles, and they are de-racialization of the rural economy, democratic and equitable use of land across race, gender, and class, and the third one is strict production discipline. A new sub-program of development was added to the land reform program. Before 2009, the land reform program had three elements: redistribution, tenure reform, and restitution. The element of development was added following a realization that properties that were transferred to land reform beneficiaries were in distress, and government needed to come up with a mechanism of assisting those beneficiaries of land reform, which includes restitution. Recapitalization Development Program was then introduced, and the National Co-Management Framework, which has been finalized in the early part of 2009, then had to be aligned to this new development sub-program. The strategy for the development sub-program, the Recapitalization and Development Program, is that of strategic partnerships, which can take the form of mentorship, co-management, share equity arrangement, contract farming, and concession. So as the department was developing a program that would assist beneficiaries to develop the land that they are receiving, we have to take into account the fact that there are many, many land uses that are there. Hence, when we define strategic partnership, co-management is one of the forms of strategic partnerships that are possible. Co-management for the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform has four pillars: tangible benefits, transformation, transparency and accountability, and risk mitigation. Now, these four pillars, the National Co-Management Framework complies with these four pillars, so there wasn't an issue of alignment. We then have inserted in slide 12 a process that is followed within the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform in assisting rural communities. We have had to insert this slide so that we can demonstrate to the honorable members how work is done in department. Now, when we settle claims, remember, our role as a commission is to solicit claims, to receive those claims, to investigate them, and to attempt to resolve them through negotiation and mediation. So when we negotiate and mediate, we are doing that with main parties, one of which is the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform. And once land has been given through restitution, beneficiary must be assisted. So there are other branches within the department that are vital in the process of settlement of claims. Now, in the past, before 2009, when the commission wanted to settle a claim, it would not go and buy land and give it to beneficiaries. When those beneficiaries needed development support, the commission itself had staff that were employed, dedicated, to go and assist those beneficiaries. So we were basically working in silos. Now, in rural development and land reform, everything is integrated. There are other branches within the department that have a role to play in the settlement of claims. So in rural development, generally, The first question that is asked is, where are we going to implement this comprehensive rural development program? If you look at the left there, we look at the strategic infrastructure project. 23 districts have been approved by cabinet for the implementation of rural development. These are the 23 forest districts and municipalities in the country. We look at existing comprehensive rural development sites. We look at the provincial growth and development strategies. We look at district and local municipality IDPs. We look at information that comes from the center. And there is an institution that we are in the process of establishing called the Land Management Commission, which will assist government with its land administration. Once it is in place, then it will also assist in the identification of areas where rural development must be done. And then we have a branch that is called Spatial Planning and Land Use Management. That's PLUM. There was a Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Act. It was a bill. It was passed this year by both Houses of Parliament. It was signed off by the President a week or so ago. That branch assists the country with planning, in terms with planning on the space, with spatial planning. And the Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Act requires that there must be a national development framework and a provincial development framework and then spatial development framework at the district and local level. Now, those plans are then going to assist the country to say, the land use in that area is agriculture, there is this, there is that, there is that. Now, they would, in a normal rural development site, go and determine what is the status of the particular area. They will then come up with a status quo report that says, finally, this is what is happening. Photographs get taken before the department comes in to do its work. If you then move over to that part where it's written LR, strategic acquisition. LR stands for land reform. That remember we said land reform has four elements, redistribution, restitution, tenure reform, and development. Acquisition of land, that takes place if that is what is required. In the most of the 23 district municipalities, they are found, most of them are in the former homeland area. The land is mostly owned by the state, communal land. In those instances, we don't have to acquire the land is there. And then we use the land as a resource for all the projects that are implemented. Restitution will then be part of land reform, and where we acquire land, then that we would acquire land when the branch plan has already gone and done a status quo report. We then have another branch called Rural Enterprise and Industrial Development. They assist with social organization and development issues. They look at who is this person that we are trying to assist, how must we assist them, what kind of assistance do these beneficiaries want. They do household profiling where each household determines what it is that they want and what is the order in which government must follow in meeting their needs. They assist with the issue of training, production input, strategic partnerships, particularly when enterprises are established, skills development, training, etc., etc. Then the last branch is rural infrastructure development, which then assists and coordinates other governments to provide infrastructure that may be needed to make a particular project sustainable. So all of these branches are the main self-delivery branches within the department, which have to participate in the process towards the settlement of claims. We think that if we implement rural development in this fashion, we are then not going to have in the future instances where beneficiaries receive land and that land lies dormant. Now, if you then look at the progress with regards to settlement of the claims on protected areas. We presently have 150 claims on protected areas. There are claims that are still outstanding, and there is an ad hoc committee that has been established by this House to assist the Commission with issues of restitution, particularly the opening of those claims. That committee is going to also help us with a process. Its first meeting was yesterday, so to help us with the process of quantifying, a right way of quantifying the claims that are outstanding. We have made, we have explained to them some of the challenges that we have had in the past with our statistics, and they are then going to be giving us guidance in terms of how we must determine and respond to the question how many claims are outstanding. So presently, 150 claims are lodged on protected areas. 46 of those have been settled. Awards of land have been made. Unfortunately, for a large majority of the claimants there, the land is unsurveyed, unregistered state land, and as a result, many processes must be done before the land can actually be transferred to the beneficiaries. And once transferred, honourable members will remember that we said the communities, the claimants, cannot go back and physically occupy the land. 44 of the claims are currently being researched. Apologies for the psychological error, they have not been reached, it's being researched. 13 have been accepted and published in the Government Gazette. Verification is currently taking place in 4 claims. 24 claims are at negotiation stage, with a further 9 at settlement stage. 4 claims are presently before court, where there are disputes that are being adjudicated. Slide 14 then set out a provincial breakdown of the statuses of all the claims. The honourable members will remember earlier on, we took them through a process that is followed in the institution, and these numbers must then be read together with the slide that talks about the process that is followed. The challenges that we have experienced in settlement of these claims, I think for me, the first one, even before overlapping and submitting claims, is a question that I was asked about 5 years ago by a group of communities in KwaZulu-Natal, and I will ask it nicely in Zulu. Bathi, ubani obalulekile phakathi kwethu nalezilwane? Who is important between us, the people, and this animal? And that was in the context of us trying to explain to communities the importance of conservation and why, in as much as we want to return their land, we can't give it to them and then they go and occupy. They said, we need land, chase away the animals so we can go in. We used to live there. We'll be able to do so. And when we explained the importance of conservation, they then asked the question, between the animals and us, who is important? The challenges, I didn't answer. The challenges are overlapping and competing claims where more than one community has claimed the same piece of land. Conflict between claimants or their legal entities and traditional leadership institutions. When we restore land, most of the time, we will restore it when a community has been removed to a trust or to a communal property association. Those entities, there is a conflict between them and traditional leadership institutions. Sometimes we cannot even restore the title of the land because the traditional institution, traditional authority, traditional leader will come and stop us from restoring the land. Most of the land is unsurveyed and unregistered state land, and the benefits from co-management agreements are minimal. The management agencies have argued that they barely make enough money to meet their operational requirements. They don't make a profit, and therefore they cannot afford the cost of co-management. There must be skills development in co-management, the number of meetings suddenly increased. They must employ people from the community that they must transfer to those people. And they have argued that those popular, which we referred to earlier, they need, they require funding and they do not have funds for that. And without clear funding commitment from management authority, when we are now facilitating the negotiations between the claimants and the management authorities and everyone else, without any commitment to fund anything, then the claimant will get into entering into co-management agreement. We have been told by Environment, the Department of Environment, that the majority of the management of, authorities don't have money. They hardly survive. The only authority that is able to survive is the South African National Park, and that is because of the income that is generated by Kruger National Park, which is then used to cross-subsidize the operation on the on Dada Park. What have we done, or what are we doing about these challenges? Firstly, to deal with overlapping and committing claims, we have partnered with the Human Sciences Research Council and the University of South Africa, and we are looking at other universities, especially rural universities, to help us with the research of claims. If you can, with proper research and proper information, you are then able to deal with claims that are competing. Some of them, even with research, it will be difficult to deal with, because some of the land was occupied by different communities at different intervals. So community would be sitting here, they are removed somewhere else, and another one comes and settles where the first community had been. And in some instances, both of them have a right in land, and those ones require a little bit more than research. The National Development Plan called for a district land reform committee, which are going to be made up of all stakeholders who are then going to assist government when it does end reform. And we are hoping that once we get those committees up and running, they will then also assist us to deal with overlapping claims, especially now that land claims are likely to be reopened. So the challenge of legal entities and traditional leaders, we are developing a new communal land tenure policy. The honorable members will remember that the Communal Land Rights Act, UGLARA, was enacted to assist government regulate land administration in communal areas. That act was found to be unconstitutional, and we have to go back to the drawing board. We are working on a policy which we are currently engaging our stakeholders on. This policy already is proposing how issues of conflict between legal entities and traditional authorities must be dealt with. It provides for how land administration in communal areas must take place. For the challenge of unregistered and unsurveyed land, state land audit was conducted. It was finalized. Its report is on its way to cabinet, after which it will then be made available. And the land that was uncovered is in the process of being surveyed. As part of the audit, most of the land had to be covered, and the processes of registering those survey diagrams of transferring and vesting the land to the state are taking place, and once that has been complete, then the land will then, the state will then be able to transfer the land to the claimant. We are also looking at alternative funding models for co-management. The challenge there that we are trying to address was the challenge where the management authorities who enter into a co-management agreement with the community say they do not have money. So we are looking at the development program, sub-program within the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform for assistance. But the challenge with that program is that it does not fund everything. Some of the things funding must come from elsewhere. And there's ongoing work of educating communities about the importance of conservation and environment, people and park program is very helpful in that regard. So the way forward with regards to claims on protected areas other than the Kruger National Park is that settlement plans have been developed for each and every one of the outstanding claims. With the assistance of Environmental Affairs, the Commission and Management Authorities were able to develop those plans. They say exactly who must do what by when so that the claim can be settled. And in terms of this plan, 50% of the outstanding claims will be finalized by the end of the next financial year, which will end in March 2015. The settlement shall be preceded by the development of business plans and park-specific co-management agreements. The current management authorities will become strategic partners of the claimant, and through co-management agreements, through the framework that has been developed and the recapitalization and development program, support shall then be provided so that these co-management agreements can work. Without the co-management agreements working, then there will be conflict between the new owners of the land and the management authorities who have been appointed by a government to manage land that has been protected. With regard to the Kruger National Park, there was a cabinet decision in 2002 that said if land is a protected area, you can restore the land, give ownership, but people are not going to be able to go back and resettle. In December 2008, Sunparks and Environmental Affairs and Tourism, they approached cabinet and they informed cabinet that communities were unhappy with the restricted title, arguing that the restrictions were imposed against their will. They told cabinet that communities viewed revenue generation from the land as a priority over biodiversity conservation and wanted operations to be run the same manner as ecotourism practices in adjacent private game reserves. And this was mostly in the Kruger National Park. So the way that the park, Kruger National Park, is managed, communities felt that they were being shortchanged, because if Sunparks is not making money, then the communities, the benefits that are going to accrue to them were minimal. This is mostly the Makulenge community, who is the only community or who is one of the few communities that has been given title on land which is within the Kruger National Park. They then argued in cabinet that these challenges threaten national heritage, they threaten the iconic status and the international recognition that is given to the Kruger National Park. On the basis of their argument, cabinet approved that only equitable rivers would be the means of settling land claims within the Kruger National Park. Basically what this means is that in the Kruger National Park, when we settle claims, we cannot give title deeds, we cannot restore the land to the communities that have claimed land within the park. What can be available are any other means of settling a claim other than giving a title deed. So in a normal park, we would give the claimant who want land a title deed, which has the condition that you cannot settle on the land. But in Kruger National Park, we can't even give that title deed. We then had to find a way of striking a balance and ensuring the community's benefit. So we made representations to cabinet and requested that when cabinet, if cabinet were to approve what was requested by Sunparks and Environmental Affairs, there must then be principles that would guide how the cases will be settled. And Cabinet approves that there must be a beneficiation scheme that must form part of the equitable redress model in order to ensure fair and equitable compensation for the claimant. The beneficiation scheme must result in tangible, realistic, and optimal beneficiation that in the settlement of claims in the Kruger National Park must uphold the principles of economic viability, financial sustainability, and holistic management of protected conservation areas, and that post-settlement use should be compatible with conservation and protected areas legislation. We then conducted with Environmental Affairs a scoping exercise to inform the beneficiation scheme that Cabinet said must be established. And a report, service providers were employed to go and look at all projects that could be implemented for and on behalf of communities that have claimed land, so that what comes out of those projects can then increase benefits that would accrue to communities. The report has been accepted by all the parties, and we are now in a process of developing the projects that were identified further, trying to find funding for them, developing business plans for them, and in the process, that will assist, or rather that will lead to the finalization of the settlement of claims in the Kruger National Park. Now, some communities, if you look at the challenges about the settlement of claims in the Kruger National Park, some communities have engaged legal representatives who have advised them that they can challenge this decision of Cabinet of saying the land in Kruger National Park should not be restored. Now, when Cabinet considered in 2008, when it took the decision that says land will not be restored in the Kruger National Park, the Commission had informed Cabinet that in terms of Section 29(4) of the Restitution Act, the Commission is required to provide assistance in the form of legal representation to an indigent party that has claimed restitution. So when those communities are not happy about how government is approaching the settlement of claims, we would have a responsibility and a duty where it is necessary to do so, to provide such representation. Some communities, especially from the Limpopo province part of the Kruger National Park, have indicated that they prefer that their claims be referred to courts because they are not happy. We are still trying to engage those communities with a view of trying to get an agreement that would have us implement the decisions that are taken by Cabinet, but at the same time maximizing the benefits that will accrue to the communities. The way forward, this is the way forward on the claims of the Kruger National Park is that Rural Development and Land Affairs, Environmental Affairs, SANParks are developing a framework for the settlement of each of the claims in the Kruger National Park, and once a common position has been established, then that position will be taken to the claimant community, and in that position you will then have all the projects that particular community can implement, supported by business plan that would indicate what would be contributed by government, what benefits will accrue to the community, so that when they take a decision about what must be done with their claim, they do so having all the details at their disposal. In this claim, the outstanding restitution processes have been finalized, for example, where claims, research of claims have not been conducted, verification of households, etc. That is being done parallel to this, so that the moment the community says yes, we are happy about what has been proposed, we would then be in a position to then go and refer that claim to the Minister for Settlement. We have a task team that meets on a monthly basis to monitor implementation of the plans that have been developed for the Kruger National Park. And then for the plan on the other protected areas, within the people and parks program, there is a steering committee where all the parties are represented, the communities, those communities that have claimed, neighboring communities, management authorities, environmental affairs, and ourselves, where we participate. That group then monitors implementation of these settlement plans that have been developed. With regard then, Chair, as I conclude, to claims that have an impact on tourism products, we are currently struggling with the Department of Tourism. They have, for example, requested us to provide them with all land claims that have a tourism potential. And it is very, very difficult. From the just over 6,000 claims that have been settled by an award of land, which basically equates to some 3 million hectares, it's very difficult for us, after the fact, to go and determine whether this land has tourism potential, that one doesn't. Our presentation focused on claims on protected conservation areas that are owned by the state. They are claims on protected conservation areas that are owned and managed by private people. Every game relies, whether protected or not, there is tourism within that game reserve, lodges, etc., etc. We are now looking at the strategies that have been recently developed by the Department of Tourism, strategy to boost domestic tourism, and their strategy to boost tourism and promote tourism even in some of the rural areas. The Department of Arts and Culture is developing a national coins and heritage route. And we have established a task team that is made up of all these relevant departments to try and see how we can share information and how we can then assist each other to make sure that information that is required is available. We have indicated to the Department of Tourism the difficulty that we will have in going back to the 3 million hectares and trying to identify and determine which one of the properties have a tourism potential or there is some infrastructure there that can be built on by government or by beneficiaries themselves, which will result in a situation where tourists can occupy that land. We have details of property description. We have details of land uses for the claims that were settled recently. But claims that were settled, especially a long time ago, 4 years going towards inception, such information was not kept. Even today, when we say we got the land use, in our report, we will say we acquired 13,000 hectares. It's a private game reserve. If you don't know the private game reserve have tourism potential, then you wouldn't list it. It will say forest, and some of the forests have lodges in them. The plantation, most of them were owned by the state, and when people from head office or from wherever were visiting the plantation, they would then have their own lodge. Some of those lodges are even made available to tourists. The likes of Sapis and the Mondis also have those. So unless you physically go to the property, it is sometimes very difficult to verify what is there. What we are currently about to do is an audit of the land that has been awarded, where we are going to be looking at exactly what is happening on that land, visiting each and every one of the 3 million hectares that you are talking about. This is an exercise that will take roughly about 6 months to do, visiting each and every one of the lands that we have awarded. And we have said to the Department of Tourism that once that exercise has been done, we will then be in a better position of saying, this is a land that we have, and this is like an inventory of what is on the land, and then we can then come up with a way of determining potential. But as a start, claims that have been settled, where there are parks, where there are game reserves, some of them are just easy. There is a claim in the Fish River Sun, in the Eastern Cape, in the White Horse Sun, in the Eastern Cape. There were claims on Sun City in the Northwest. And others that have become well known in the recent past, where we can just give them that information and maybe that can form the basis of a start. And they can then see what it is that can be done whilst we are conducting this work. So that, honorable members and chair, the work that we have currently been doing, we have been delayed, I won't say frustrated, delayed somewhat by the changes in the way the government has been, in the changes of decision because of lessons that have been learned where we have had to adapt to what we have been doing. The relationship between ourselves and management authorities, between management authorities and communities is improving, and we are able to work with them, whereas in the past, the relationship was not that good. So there is improvement, and we are hoping that in the next 3 years or so, we can deal with all the claims lost in 1998, which are on protected conservation areas. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Chief Land again, Commissioner. Let us do this. Let us have a coffee break for 5 minutes and come back to our question. And then the tea is ready there, but what I suggest is that we come back with our cup of tea, drink tea while we are waiting. We don't have time now. But thank you very much for a very, very interesting presentation. There are a lot of things that we took for granted we did not know. Thank you.
You need to get your food, madam. I'm not sure. on that issue.
Thank you very much, honorable members and our distinguished presenters. Firstly, we shall circulate a get-well card for one of us who is in hospital or has been in hospital after a car accident. So with all your links so that we can send to them. That is Mama Gas. Mama Jove, is she still off sick as well? Oh, okay. Well, we do not have two cards, but what I thought of in the morning was Mama Gas, because I got a report that she was off sick. But I think, are we meeting next week? Are we not meeting next week? If we meet next week, we'll try and collect a second card. But let's start somewhere. Now sometimes it's going to have your feel, and she is going to say, this is somebody. I know it, and he will do as well. And we'll try, I don't know how we'll make it, but we talk with them and see whether it's not possible to get another one, the two of them. But I want you to sign them so that she can feel that we are with her. Okay, let's go.
Like the sun touching the water.
Yes. Thanks. Okay, over to you, Mr. Faro. Then Mr. Shah.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to Mr. Ngonza and the team for the very valued contribution. I think I've learned a lot of it, particularly since we now 100 years celebration of the land. It's appropriate that you actually did this, so congratulations also to the Chair for bringing this to our notice. I think that having just come back from oversight visits and seen how successful some co-management agreements exist, I just want to establish, first of all, whether through this process of resettlement on these protected areas, the Department or Lands Claim Commission has in fact come up with a model which can be replicated and used, or even if it is modified slightly, to enable them to move faster and to get this thing into a position where it can in fact work. And work, I talk about sustainability and financial stability, etc., etc. Now, some of the things we saw in our recent oversight visits in these parks where we went to were quite unique in the sense that the trustees and the beneficiaries were not only seeing benefit from co-sharing the gate entries for entrance as one example, but also it extended beyond that into providing laundry services, providing catering services, etc. And that has to be packaged in such a way that there is a spread of the beneficiary, because clearly I think I have to also sort of agree with what the cabinet had agreed on, and that is that, you know, it's very difficult once a protected area has been established now to remove that land and to give land back. So we've got to find answers within the confines of that particular development to see how we can establish some sort of a coherent management or fair, equitable distribution. Now, in the presentation, Mr. Mdontra, you mentioned the fact that, you know, it's fine approval because there's a big throughput to this, big money coming through the gate entry, so you can actually do an equitable share and say, look, if there's a claim for 10,000 hectares of Fuga and there's 100,000, we can work on at least taking 10% of the gate money off and saying, well, that goes back into the community, or alternatively some other sort of concessions. But the bottom line is this, that SAPARKS, and we have them in front of this committee, even though they don't fall under the Department of Tourism, doesn't only run Kruger National Park. There might be other parks where the gate hankings are not that sustainable, and in which case it should be some cross-subsidization. And I'm wondering whether this avenue has been looked at, because the tendency is with a lot of these agencies of government is that they seem to think that every operation is a cost center in its own right, and they ring-fence everything, and, you know, but the fact is term parks operates across the length and depth of the country, and very much in the same way as I suppose, you know, toll gates work, you know, collectively it's to the benefit of everybody. And I think you opened up the conversation this morning with the words that, you know, we're trying to make this country work. Now, if that's not a solution, the other thing is this. The Department of Tourism funds many entrepreneurs and trustees and beneficiaries across the country, and if there's a tourism potential that can be identified, surely you should be also knocking on the door of the department and saying, look, we've got a problem here. How are you going to come to the party in this initiative in ensuring that we have given funding to those beneficiaries, which we do, although we see some cases it hasn't been working very well, but where there's a proper business plan developed on behalf of those communities. And then that funding can flow, and we can get on with the job of ensuring that the people get back some form of compensation. Another issue which I want to put into your thought process, there's a tourism levy on every institution that generates income from tourism. It's called the TOMSA levy, T-O-M-S-A. Now that levy is there to, first of all, be used by the South African Tourist Board to initiate and to advertise and to promote tourism in those particular venues and those particular tourist sites across the country, be it Kruger Park, be it, you know, Table Mountain, whatever. Now, we've been told by SANPARKS that they are withholding the tourism levy. They are withholding that tourism levy for the simple reason that they feel that they can put that money back into communities. Now, we don't know whether in fact that is happening and whether you have got a finger on that pulse, because quite honestly there should be quite a lot of money that has to come through that top of the levy, which has now been diverted to go to so-called community development adjacent to the Kruger Park and adjacent to where they operate. And I think that there's another opportunity where you must look at maybe that money be given to them in compensation for other financial gain. So the last thing I want to say, and it's ironic that that thing is up there, please could you also, I don't know, maybe just by emailing us, give us a breakdown of what is actually public protected areas, in other words, state-owned protected areas, and what you were talking about in the last sort of discussion about private owned protected area. We need to know what the association is there, because they've got to be dealt with differently. And, you know, maybe if we knew that, we could actually see how to assist as well. Thanks.
Arms rather than Mr. Shah. Thank you, Concejal, for our time.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Well, with that is my time. I was really impressed. Thank you very much for it was wonderful. Because people are complaining that the land claims, the restitution is going very slow. But as I was listening, it seems maybe there is an improvement. I don't know how far true that is. Because now I'm looking at the processing of claims, which maybe other people don't have that opportunity to read and see what actually is being followed in order that the claim comes through. Well, I would love to get it from the presenter whether really and truly things are now going better than it used to be. And one other thing, I would like to support the idea of projects that can be, you know, introduced to the communities around the parks, because we always worry, what are those parks doing for the communities around them? But now when projects, as you mentioned, are introduced, I think life can go better for our people.
Thank you
very
much.
Thank you,
Chair. I'd like to thank Mr. Ndonswa. As he was talking, I mean, there's a lot of questions that came to my mind, and as we went along during the presentation, he answered those questions, which is a good sign. On page 2, under the overview of the restitution program, since that those who received compensation, I know this might not directly relate to tourism, but I would like some clarity. Since those who receive compensation that is just and equitable at the time of disposition do not qualify. Now, I want to find out what criteria or how did they quantify the true value of the land at the time of disposition? Because you're doing the evaluation now. Suppose in 1960, due to Group A's Act, land and home and everything was taken away from a family. Are you saying that if that family received 2,000 rands, and if there was a value, let's say it was 6,000 rand, then the 4,000 rand discrepancy, that's what's going to be settled? Is that what this means? If that's what it means, I still think it's unfair, because they didn't ask for the homes and lands to be taken. And had they not been taken, the value of that property and home today, market value would be much different. So can you just tell me why it is that the compensation is based on the time of this? How do you quantify that value of that time, whether it's 20 years, 30, 40 years ago? On page 8, you speak about benefits from co-management agreements that are minimal. I just wanted to know, do we have a breakdown, or do we know how many co-management agreements have been signed? And specifically, how many of those relate to tourism products? Patient, under the settlement framework, bullet 2, a report has been finalized setting out economic opportunities that exist for communities inside and outside the of park. Now this report, where is this report? Where is it at the moment? Did the National Department of Tourism get a copy of it? Or is it possible for this committee to have a look, see that report? Then quickly on page 11, what is it? Yeah. It says in bullet 2, challenges, under challenges, on page 11, in bullet 2, in terms of section 29.4 of the Restitution Land Act, to provide legal representation at its expense to assist payment communities to refer their claims to court. Now, do you have sufficient budget to provide that service, is that not having a financial strain and impact on your overall budget? I just want to know that. And finally, you raised the issue about your relationship with, you know, NDT. Why is the National Department of Tourism not involved in this, you know, entire process? What is its role in this entire process? Should it not be involved at a closer level, you know, so that it can, you know, see how it is being affected, you know? I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. And once again, thanks for the presentation. The Clara. I know that there was a constitutional decision, constitutional court decision regarding the matter, which in one way or the other, we were quite excited when it was passed some generations ago. But ultimately then had to be nullified. What is there to then begin to address that particular situation? I'm thinking in terms of the land tenure, particularly in the rural areas, because it linked directly to that. I'm saying this because in the rural areas, you'd realize that our own people were never thoroughly educated about the process. For them, it was all about getting the money. Now, they never understood the value of the land as against what is perishable. I have to cite a case here, which quickly, the issue of Port St. John's. The way it was done, in a way, excited some, but not all. Because the people within that particular area, they saw Port St. John's as a tourist attraction. I'm talking about some. Where then they expected that they were going to be in a joint venture with government to see that Port St. John's become the icon of tourism in the Southern Hemisphere. Having said that, you just mentioned that some records are no more existing in one or the other because that claim was settled. It might as well be falling into that particular category. I'm not sure. But having said that, there is what they call the Laga Game Reserve. What happened around that particular one, because now we're talking about partnering, empowering the people, but my understanding, I might be wrong, did not involve nor include those people regarding that particular game reserve. But quickly what then happened was for those people to be given money and understand. For me then, to get a clarity, to then say, if you are then saying you're going to visit and see what is actually happening and what happened then and to date, will there be some measures in assisting those people in some instances where they were shortchanged? Thank you, Chair.
I forgot this point. The communities argue who is important, us and the animals. And I'm saying, I'm grateful that this committee, your committee, is promoting domestic tourism. Because when they go around, they will be educated. They will fall in love seeing those animals because it's all about them. But now when they are not going around seeing screens, going to parks, you name them, really and truly they are supposed to say who is important to us and the animals. They just the animals. They don't know why are those animals there for.
Are you finished, Selma?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, there are communities like here, Tugutu, in KwaZulu-Natal, and there could be a number of communities as well who are asking the same questions. And particularly because there was no negotiation with them when this places were reclassified as conservation areas in some instances, but I think it is important that to take what is given as given for purposes of better management, because otherwise then you start other processes that are even more complex than what is facing the team. But shortly, I just wanted to check on the issue on settlement framework management. Are you finding it easy to get resources and capacity to fulfill their mandate? Number two, that is the people, the expertise, the wherewithal to fulfill that mandate, particularly in rural areas. Secondly, perhaps these district reform committees, where are they now? I know that this thing is just recent, and what are the timelines, what are the deadlines that we have given ourselves? Then the last one, whether the department has determined on what steps were the problem of compensation or perhaps is dissatisfying, there could be something like a land equivalent distinct compensation, a sort of monetary compensation as a form of negotiating towards a settlement on this, particularly around the areas where the government says they are not going to have physical occupation. But at the same time, you do not have money or the skill or support to run a game, to run something in a game reserve. That is all from me. But after you have made your responses, I'd like someone from the Department of Tourism just to have two or three sentences and see how perhaps together you can work. And then from our content advisor to raise some few issues as well as a specialist in the area. Okay, over to you, Mr. Mtota.
Thank you, Chair, and to the honorable members for their questions. The model. Yes, we do have a model for the settlement. But the model does not apply everywhere. If you look at just one example, in the Isimangaliso Wetland Park on the northern part of KZN, we've got about 12 communities that have claimed in that area. One of them have claimed land that is zoned within the park as a wilderness. Land that is zoned the wilderness in a protected area, you are not even allowed to ride a bicycle there. You are not allowed to build anything because you are going to disturb the birds. So people go to that part of the park to look at the birds. By the time they get into that park, they would have paid gate fees on a particular entry point. And the entry point where there are gate fees must be shared with community number 8, who was removed from that area. So for my poor community that has claimed the land, know the wilderness, you can go and you can settle the claim, use the same modem as you would use elsewhere, but they will still get very little benefit, if anything at all, because of issues of donation. The parks are managed in terms of integrated management plans, which would determine even what can be done within a park, and where you want to, for instance, put up accommodation facilities. Yes, there could be potential for a certain number of beds, but the processes that must be followed to get approval to put up a structure are so detailed and so much. You have to go through environmental impact assessments and all those processes. Sometimes benefits are needed by a community there and then. And then you find in Isangali, so in the Kruger National Park, those big parks, accommodation would be clustered in a particular area. And because of the multiple number of communities that have claimed, the benefits then must accrue according to what is on the piece of land. Then you find that community number three, who has claimed land where all the restaurants are, all the accommodation is, they basically get a better deal compared to the rest. So we do have a model, but we always try and come up with a park-specific, community-specific model, but the principles are the same that are contained there in the national international co-management framework. The Thompson list, with some parks, we've been interacting with them a lot, but this is information that we didn't know. We do know that they support communities, but we thought that they do so from their own profit, not from income such as the levy. We will certainly inquire further from them and just try and see really how we can then have that levy as an additional benefit to what we put on the table for the community. The breakdown in terms of public protection, there's a breakdown, and we can give the list in terms of location and where which parks are claimed by which community, etc. The privately owned one, we are going to find the information. That one's not readily available. Funding information will include acquiring from provincial and national Department of Environment, asking them for a list of management authorities that have been appointed, because once the land is protected, the MEC or the minister, if it's a national park, but most of these would be provincial ones, to just try and get a list of those where there are their management authorities appointed, and then we can then zoom into those properties and find whether they are claimed or not. The Zululand Rhino Reserve, for example, in Kuze, in KZN, is a private protected area. But if you were to just go and engage the people there, you would not know. We knew because of dealing in detail with the claim. My boss will answer the question about whether the process is slow or better, or whether there is improvement. Just in the reasonable compensation, Section 2.2 of the Restitution Act says you are not only excluded if you received just an equitable compensation, you are also excluded if you received another consideration which is just an equitable. And then what it does is that it creates a link when it comes to the determination of whether what was given was just an equitable with the Constitution. Section 25.3 of the Constitution says this is how to determine just and equitable compensation, and there it's in context of an appropriation. 25.1 will say you have a right to your property. 25.2 limits that right by providing the same state with the powers of expropriation, and 25(3) says if land is an expropriation, this is how to determine just and equitable compensation. There are factors that are listed there which must be taken into account. Now, 25(3) of the Constitution was not, it didn't exist at the time when dispossessions took place. So what the Act and what the courts have said we must do is that we must go and apply these factors at the point of dispossession. So, the Group Area Act dispossession that took place, a person who happened to belong to a race that was not allowed to occupy a particular part of town and was expropriated, they would have been paid some form of compensation. Now, what we then do is that we go and we conduct what we call a historical valuation. We employ a valuer, professional valuer, to go back in time and determine what was the market value of the land at the time of dispossession. We will then say to the valuer, he or she must determine, never seen a woman fund, must determine, seriously, I'm thinking of a valuer as I can't remember a woman fund. We must determine we would then employ a valuer who must determine the market value at the time of dispossession, and he or she must then go and apply the hectares listed in 25(3) of the Constitution. Now, those hectares are market value, the extent of state investment, how whether people suffered, and all those things. And it's very difficult, other than market value, it's very difficult for a valuer to quantify the other factors. In fact, it is so difficult to quantify those factors that the courts themselves, the constitutional court in particular, has applied them, has taken them into consideration, but they've never said, okay, for this suffering is worth 100 rand or 1,000 or 1,000,000. They will say we've taken it into account and therefore prices, and therefore this was just inequitable or it was not just inequitable. So to one of the things that we are doing in the department is the establishment of an Office of a Valuer General who's going to determine norms and standards applicable for valuation. And in doing so, they're then going to try and give effect, explore these factors as part of what the valuer general is going to do. So in the future, we will have great clarity on what really, how to quantify these other factors. So coming back then to this one, we would then say X was, X amount should have been just, would be just and equitable. And we then look at what was paid versus this amount. If there was a shortfall, we would then take the shortfall, bring it into today's value using the communal property index, and that is what we would be paying.
Can I follow up with that one quickly?
Lord help us.
Yes,
sir. We'll follow up with the committee.
And then in terms of the number of co-management agreements that we have signed, this is an area where we are going to commit to revert to the committee in writing so that we can provide proper information, proper and updated information. The report on the economic opportunities and benefits in the Kruger National Park, we are going to just request the Department of Environment if we can make it available, but we don't think that will be a problem. We participated in the development of terms of reference in the determination of the project, but they are the owners of the product. They pay for it. We will request from them permission to make it available. The Chief Land Claims Commissioner will deal with legal representation at our expense. And the question about the Sri Lanka Game Reserve and Port St. George. Dugudugu is a very complex area of KZN. with its neighboring communities. Some of the land that is claimed by Dugudugu is a state forest. Some of it is protected. And yes, it's true, people were not consulted when what used to be their land, the land use was changed. It's the legacy of past government. But we are trying to work with that community to find solutions. There are, again, conflicts within the community itself, which sometimes make it difficult for us to deal with them. In the rural spaces where these claims are, the people and the expertise are normally not there. But through the strategy of strategic partnership, we always find someone who is going to assist the community to actually implement. Insofar as our expertise to come up with this, we partner on this mostly with government departments. When we talk about trying to come up with things of the Isimangaliso Wetland Park, we talk to Kruger National Park. We talk to environment. When we are trying to address issues with South African National Park, we go to someone else to get advice. And there are former civil servants in particular that have run even both South African and National Park that sometimes we will consult just to get information and advice on developing some of these things. And obviously, the Department of Environment plays a crucial role. When it used to be environmental affairs and tourism, I think somewhere at the back of our minds, we always thought that they are one department, so when we were interacting with them, they would take everything into consideration. With the best of the Department of Tourism, what we have known is that they had to spend a lot of their 4 years developing policies and strategies and sharpening their axe, so to speak. And there was some interaction about a year or so ago, and we are going to follow that up, and we are going to ensure that we work with them. With the assistance that they provide when they have tourism or potential, that will also assist to augment some of the funding that may come from our own development program. Lastly, the District Land Reform Committee. We had actually proposed a similar body, and we were calling them Land Management Committee, Land Rights Management Committee. We are piloting these committees in the Northwest, where we are trying to just pilot and stakeholders sit together. They're going to help us come up with terms of reference, to determine who should be there, how should their processes work, where are they going to get secretarial support, who is going to fund them. There is a piece of legislation which is an amendment, the Extension of Security of Tenure Act. That amendment provides for the establishment of the Land Rights Management Board, which is going to assist the department to manage land tenure issues. And the Land Rights Management Board is going to have Land Rights Management Committees, and those are the district committees that the National Development Plan has now called for. And with that, with the legislation being enacted, then we will then formally establish them. But what we are doing currently is just piloting and trying to see how they are going to help. They are going to be crucial in assisting with dispute resolution. The people have said the only solution that the department provides to their problems is court, lawyer-led mediation. They have said most of their issues are social issues. We must come up with social solutions for social problems. And these committees are our other to that.
Thank you. I would say that from our perspective, we would manage to spend 100% of our budget in the past 2 years. And last year, we actually expanded the budget and also met the target that was projected in our city. We are continuing our processes generally. operating standard operating procedures so that across board in all the provinces are able to speak to one system in terms of meetings. We've got a quality control committee that helps approve specific settings so that we're sure that we are doing the right thing. And furthermore, we want to take advantage of the reopening and should it happen that we send in our on the context of the 29 for applications, which is where famous communities that are indigenous can apply for financial assistance for their children. It is putting a strain, but at the same time, it's, the act actually allows communities to do that. But we are also strengthening our policy in terms of access, because we have identified that some of the attorneys, not necessarily the attorneys, will try to take advantage of the system and take cases to court that don't necessarily need to go to court. But we're trying to put the system in place. And generally on the issue of, for example, like and other different companies where the company and all. These are things that we settled then, and we have identified the actions that we need to involve in. With the co-management agreement that we have to, we are going back to a credit community to kind of involve in. Especially because then we will pay what we call settlement for settlement grants, but now we have a rehabilitation and development policy that is supposed to then, help the community after an assessment of the type of assistance that they will need and the children's benefit. But we can provide them probably a plan in the future. How we can those are definitely on my head.
Thanks. Anything from NTT?
Thank you, Chairperson. From NDP side, we are currently undertaking a study looking at the sustainability of tourism post and settlement now. Really, the rationale is to actually look at the findings of the study and see where can we effectively intervene in such a way. Now, for us to be able to do that which we want to do, we identified that we may have to liaise with the Department of Rural Development and the Reform for us to get information as my colleague has explained here. On the 9th of July, I led a team from the department where with a meeting with the unit called Revitalization and Development within the Department. This was followed by a letter on the 27th of July to the Deputy Chief Wisma Sangu, requesting information that the colleague has actually attested to. And this our communication was actually sent to the Chief Land Claims Commission on the 31st of July. So I'm just saying that as a department, we see the need to work much closer together with the Department of World Development and the Ministry of Commission. We think that we need to share information first, but also look into the department because we've got certain projects, certain findings within the Social Responsibility Initiative, which we think we can visualize or direct it toward this particular endeavor. We think that having started this initial engagement, we will surely reinforce the close cooperation with the Land Claims Commission. We have actually raised the shared information from this meeting. I can share with the committee that we will work much closer together. Thank you.
Thank you. One of the things I would allow to think I'm covered since my colleague has already committed that there will be a follow-up in terms of the written response that will be sending to the committee, because I think we need to raise some of the issues in terms of what was presented promoting this co-management agreement, understand there is a national framework, but want to see if we can have tourism solutions in terms of participants there. So I think it's an idea that we'll take in writing up the commission. We will have a machine of issues, because we want to see, for example, issue of concession. I think a lot can happen there, because if we have issue of Kruger Park and Smaradis, so that my colleague was talking about, the way in which the concessions are given to communities, you know, they will give concessions at very exorbitant prices to the community, whereas maybe a total solution would be there to reinvent some of them for communities as part of. So I'm saying there are many issues that we can explore, but in the interest of time, Chair, I'll request that we have a written submission to the Commission through your office, so that they address those issues, then we see how then the department can then move with them. Thanks.
Okay. I think before perhaps we take concluding remarks from the Land Commissioner, let me say that we want to see a much more effective government. I'm not saying that you are not working hard, but I'm saying that there are limitations, many of which are beyond your control. And then it is the duty of all to make sure that people can work together as the National Development Plan, as is asked to do. And secondly, to look for solutions to together. And as we do oversight, we should not limit ourselves only to tourism, because tourism is empowered by different departments, rural development and other departments. And as you go on doing your work also, other possibilities that could empower tourism emerge as you do your work. And then let us capture those things in working together to make sure that our actions result in optimal results in terms of jobs, in terms of entrepreneurial usability, and in terms of growth for our country. Perhaps shortly we want to say that as a committee, but we await your concluding remarks, and then we assure you that we are going to make follow-ups from different members through our secretariat, so that we improve on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. From the side of the Commission, we just want to thank you for the opportunity. And just to mention that we are acutely aware of the fact that we cannot work in silos, and that returning the land to the claimant communities is just only a part of the work that needs to be done, not generally, not just by us as Wealth Development or Institution Commission, but by government. And so it's important that in our approach we have integrated strategy, so that when we finally give the land back, we provide a sustainable solution for the communities. And I think that that's the mandate that we have, and we have an obligation to take it forward. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. This committee will support you in whatever it can, wherever it can support you in your quite complex field. And then with those words, we say thank you very much for your presentation. Thanks. Then, going to the next item on the agenda, but before we go to the next agenda, as I was starting my car yesterday, alighting from the flight, I heard the chairperson of land reform say that we are getting too much money. The people are the portion of land settlements in terms of cash is much more. People should be encouraged to take land. So that is also a debate that will go on as we move forward. Because in some instances, people are no longer staying in those areas. They lose the land, they lost the land, they went to town. But in some instances, there are some people that are on the land. Okay, then the second number P, that is the tabling of the Free State and KwaZulu-Natal Provincial Oversight Report. We hereby table this report. It's the first draft, it is not a report. A first draft for consideration. and correction, and then we shall adopt it later. But for purposes of speedy the work, given our limited time in Parliament this term, we've got to make sure that we do our work very fast. So,
sorry, sir, can we be excused?
Yeah, you are excused.
As a proposal, once we've read the thing, submit, you know, thing that we find might be wrong, so we speed up the process. I noticed that some of these reports, you know, they take an endless amount of time, especially if we're only here for this next week, that maybe we should just get in contact with our content advisor and Jerry and say, listen, you know, and maybe look at additions or subtractions or changes, or and then it, you know, it can be shown in red, so it doesn't be defined as being a single minority report. It's got, because after all, we're all part to it, so we have to agree to it. But I mean, I'm just saying, we don't have to change things without the, everybody agreeing. But if you do it in a format that reflects a contribution from X, Y, Z, then it can actually, you know, be debated when we finally come. It'll feed up the process. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, no, your contributions as members really will be very much welcome. But what is going to happen is that we are going to be given enough time to read the final draft, and so that we, when we adopt it, and we shall have interacted with the report. We are not just going to take submissions and be quiet and say this is the final report.
Thank you. Well, look, I haven't seen the report, the draft yet. Once we've seen it, then since I try to, you know, unpack it and see where there are areas that need to change or make issues. Do you have a time frame in mind as to by when we should be doing that? Because when I get home tonight, I'm going to go through it. And by tomorrow, she'll have an idea. So do you think we could meet again to resolve this before we go home? Because once we've gone home and we've got the whole next week, we won't be here. Do we know by when we have to do this?
Let us try to make it Friday. But next week we are not sitting next week. So, but are we sitting next week but one? Because now, given the time, we've got to manage our business very carefully. There is going to be DRR as well. I do not know where we are going to fit that DRR. So we've got to be very careful now with how we go about.
Tell us now.
We come back on the 9th of September. So the first thing is on the 10th
of September.
And then we work for 1 week until the 20th, and then we go back on constituency until the 4th of October. So we are literally out for 2 weeks, in for, for 2 weeks, and out again. So,
okay. Jerry, what is workable for us?
For us, it will be much appreciated if we can get the comments from all different members of the committee at least by this coming Friday, so that thereafter we can incorporate everything. Then we have the final report, and then we also circulate it to all members. Because the experience at the same time taught us once we are at this time of the year, there's too much conversation among committees on what must be on the program of Parliament. So if we leave our report for too much, then it will get stale and it will be pushed back and back and back towards the agenda of Parliament. So the sooner we finalize, the better for us. Because most committees were on oversight, and the reports are going to be a issue now.
Yeah, in fact, this report contains a lot of things that should be attended to immediately.
Yeah.
And we tried to make a press report around the issues, but I haven't seen anything in the press. But I do not know whether it was circulated to members, therefore, by the chairperson. But it was not a report. It was just highlighting different areas and what happened. So that the people, all stakeholders, including ourselves, would know at least what was regarded as important in the report. And then perhaps if you wanted to raise issues, you could raise issues readily and from that.
I think what Jerry said was what I was also going to say. There's going to be a step of these coming through. I mean, because most committee went out and oversight. So that's number one. The second thing is this, that in order to get it into the parliamentary cycle for tabling, you need to have certain notice, I think, given of that particular thing, or that tabling of that report. And if we're only sitting from the 9th until the 20th, that gives us 4 sitting days. So I would, if I could make a suggestion, is that if we do go the route of putting comments in before Friday, let's have a quick hour in the morning of the 10th, of which is the Tuesday of September, where we can sit down and look at the report and do some refining, so we can finalize it on the 17th, following, or even, you know. Because that means then that it could go into Parliament on the, how many days is it? 3 days?
I think we'll have to submit a draft report for consideration of for taking. But after the draft report, we're going to have a lot of work to do.
Otherwise, it's
It's supposed to be next year. But also, you see, it is important that some of the reports, as part of our processing, go to the provinces.
Yes.
Because we are aware that we've got to empower each other as we go along. We cannot take things for granted. Some of the departments were just up there before. And developing skills, yes, it takes a long time, particularly in rural provinces. So we've got to make sure that we take up and make our recommendations as soon as possible. Then, Mr. Bengo.
I think your intervention is quite acceptable, because if I were to reflect what we're dealing with, some of the reports that are appearing on the paper today and people in the house, some of those reports are dating as far back as 2011. I promise you. I'm saying this because some, we're now looking into the recommendations that were made. Never out of paper the house. Now it's all history, because some of those issues have already been attended to. But then we have to up the way in which we do things, so that we push them, they get into, so that by the time we get the next budget, or rather doing what we normally do, following up with the department on this issue that has been done, we are able then to account as we normally do, the oversight of the government. So if we as the committees, we don't do that, then surely somebody outside there who's watching how we are running Parliament, and now all of us, it becomes very true. It reflects very badly. To find a report, I'm saying to find a report that is dating as far back as then, only to find ourselves having to pass that report today.
Yeah, why not read this? There's nothing.
But the other one that you raised, Chairperson, statement, yes, I did bounce on the statement. It's in the internet. So the parliament has put it through.
Okay.
And for members, if you get into that parliamentary site, there's news, blah, 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 blah. I think they were trying to educate some of the members last week to let them how to begin to access the parliamentary site.
Okay.
With all that, because it is there. I read through it. It's safe to say then that some of the issues are not chronological. We're just talking about that with him. So then say the way Parliament did it, well, it is, but it's not what we would have loved it. But having said so, it is there to say that.
Okay.
No, thank you. Then the minutes, I think the same should apply to the minutes. Next meeting, these minutes shall be adopted. Whether you are ready or not, we expect that you shall be ready by that time. Yes. Are there any other announcements?
On my side, it's only I wanted to just to refer members to speculated this response from the National Treasury. They were responding to to the recommendations of the committees that were made during the budget of the report. Their responses, I think, for us as far as the members will find them on page 10 of this document. Then members can go through it on their own.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. This is paper. So the committee remains adjourned. Thank you. Hello, Mubigana.
I would request that members of this portfolio committee, when they get to different airports, when they see things happening, they must just take over same time. You know? Yes, why? Last week, when I was going home, I was with one of the members. There was a bag. The conveyor belt was at a standstill. And there was a bag, which was just on that conveyor belt. Can you imagine? It took so many minutes for that conveyor belt to move, and that bag, you could see that it has long been lying there. I went to that window, baggage. I said, listen, what about that bag? I, here and there, I said, listen, what are you going to tell the owner when he or she comes to report that he has lost his bag? Then that young man followed me. Oh, after saying, listen, you know I'm serving in this portfolio committee where we are looking after such things not to happen. It's then that he went out of that office and followed me. And then the conveyor belt at the time had started. Then I knew the bit because it was a flower pot. Mom. This is a bag. And he took the bag, did what they should have long done to the bag. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, you don't just look at it. I fool me.
I don't know.